So our time has been shortened a little bit, so the ones that we're not going to cover, I just did a few on nutrition. You'll find another one there on fruits and vegetables and nutrition. And what we're trying to do is, again, what are the priority issues? And you'll find that fruits and vegetables, all the research is saying what? If you want to live a long time, eat more fruits and vegetables. And the new guidelines are saying as many as 5 to 9 servings a day. And if we had more time, we'd show you. You'll see in those slides that the reason they say that is because people who do that, they live longer. And so fruits and vegetables, that's what we want to promote. And then there was another one on whole grains. We talked a little bit about whole grains, but there's a whole chapter on that. And I'm just really amazed as you look at all the studies today on how whole grains is helpful. And you know, in the Adventist health study, even our own Adventist group, we compared those who used white bread regularly and those who used whole grains. They cut the risk of heart disease in half amongst those using the whole grains. And if we could do that in every church, what a big difference, just that one little thing, making their health. And then there's one on healthy fats. I didn't get to cover that one too, but you can read the thing in there. And basically the bottom line in the new research is saying is we don't need to cut back on our total fat intake as much as we need to get rid of the bad kinds of fats, the solid fats, the trans fats, and in their place use healthy fats, which would be vegetable fats. And particularly the ones that are also high in the N3 fatty acids, we need to be using those more regularly. And where would that be?
Avocados?
No, not much N3 fatty acids in avocados. Avocados are good healthy fats, though. But in the flax seed, you'll find more of the N3 fatty acids. And in walnuts, and in hazelnuts. And most of the nuts are good there, but the walnuts particularly are very high. And then of the vegetable oils, the one that's highest is canola oil, and the second one is soy. So the soy and the canola not only give you a lot of polyunsaturated fats that are healthy for you, but they also give you the N3 fatty acid, alpha-linolenic acid. And yes, and again, if you read the stuff on the internet, you'll find all kinds of rumors that have been written on canola oil, and what you want to do is just ignore all of that. None of that is true. The only part true about those things that they say is that canola comes from the word Canada and oil put together, and that's true. All the rest of it is just somebody made it up. In all the research, in fact, canola oil has the lowest saturated fat of any vegetable oil and the highest in the N3 fatty acids. And all the research shows that it's very helpful in preventing heart disease. Well, we don't think of it usually in grams, but what we think of is usually around 25 to 30% of our calories should come from fat. Mm-hmm. Actually, the recommendation goes as high as 35%, but generally we recommend 25 to 30. Now, if you don't eat that much fat, and some people recommend a very low-fat diet, around 15% of your calories, then what are you doing? It means you're eating more carbohydrate again. When you eat that, when you reduce the healthy fats and you raise the carbohydrate, your HDLs go down. And every time your HDLs go down, your risk of coronary heart disease goes up. HDLs are probably the most important blood test you can do to see whether you have a heart attack or not. It's even more important than LDL cholesterol. And so most people, you'll be healthier if you have around about 25 to 30% of your calories from fat, but make sure they're healthy fats. And you can look through those articles. What you'll find in there's no correlation between total fat intake and risk of heart disease. Many people are surprised by that. But when you take the 100,000 health nurses and the 45,000 health professional studies that Harvard did their study on, and you take their fat intake and from low fat to high fat, there is no difference at all in heart disease. But if you look at their saturated fat intake, the more they eat, the higher the risk. And on the polyunsaturated fat intake, when you look at the quintiles, the more polyunsaturated fat they eat, the lower the risk. And every time their polyunsaturated fat goes up, their risk drops. Well, we need more of the polyunsaturates, and that's what we saw on this list. Most people aren't getting enough polyunsaturates, and they're getting too many of the bad kinds. So what they say is take out the bad kinds, replace it with the good kinds. What they show is that if you take a quintile of groups, every fifth level, Every time there's an increase in polyunsaturated fats, the risk of heart disease goes down. Just like when we were looking at fiber, every time there was an increase in fiber, the risk of heart disease went down, risk of diabetes went down. And we see the same thing on healthy fats and diabetes risk. Anytime there's an increase in saturated fats, the risk of diabetes goes up. Every time there's an increase in polyunsaturated fats, the risk of diabetes goes down. So they're protective against both heart disease and diabetes. And we also find it's protective to the brain and Alzheimer's disease. The healthy fats, and particularly the N3 fatty acids, protective against Alzheimer's. Olive oil is good too. Olive oil does not happen to have very much N3 fatty acid, neither is it real high in polyunsaturates. But it is a healthy fat. It's mostly monounsaturated fatty acid. So you wouldn't want to use it entirely. It'd be best to use some canola, soy, sunflower, or some others with that to get the polys with that. You used to hear that we should have the majority of our calories from monounsaturated fat. In the last 5 years, that thinking has begun to reverse. And all the new studies now are coming out saying the polyunsaturated fats are the healthiest fat we can eat. And the latest study showed as much as 15% of their calories were given. This was a clinical trial where they actually controlled the diets and gave them up to 15% of their calories from polyunsaturated fats. That's even higher. Before they said, don't go over 10%. And so they gave them up to 15, and what they found is the more polyunsaturated fats they ate, the fewer heart attacks they had. And so now the American Heart Association has come out with new guidelines on that. Other organizations have as well. So it's the polyunsaturated fats that are most protective. Now the monos are okay, but they don't lower the risk as much as the polys do. Avocado is mostly monounsaturated fat. But again, it's a healthy fat, but it's you want some others. And then the nuts are mostly polyunsaturated fats, especially like walnuts. They're very high in the polys and so on. Almonds are very good that way too.
Some news about coconuts.
And the coconut, what is coconut? Coconut is mostly saturated fat and oleic acid. Very little polyunsaturates and practically no omega-3s. So we wouldn't put it in the healthiest choices. You have which?
There are new studies about...
Yes, I've read all those new studies. And what basically they're saying is it's not as bad as they thought it used to be. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best yet.
Oh, it's not the best. Because people are giving it to family who have dementia and Alzheimer's. I think that's the latest fad that I've heard. I have a friend who gives one tablespoon to a mother.
We do desperate things in desperate situations. And I've heard that too, and I've so on, but it's we don't have any evidence-based studies yet where they've given that and showed any benefit. And it's mostly people who've come up with that idea, and some grandma used it one time and they thought she got better, and now they're recommending it for everybody. But what you need is a carefully controlled study, usually a double-blind study, where half of them are given one thing and half another, and looked. And to my knowledge, that's never been done yet, and we don't have any real evidence that there's any benefit for that. There is lots of studies that show that the N3 fatty acids are protective against Alzheimer's, and the polyunsaturated fats are protective. We don't have any studies that show that the others are at this point that I've seen.
Do you know where Earth Balance falls?
Earth Balance, if you're for a spread, they use the coconut fat and things in there, don't they? Palm oil. You have to look at the ingredients. There's some that do. The only spread that I have found that I could recommend would be Take Control. Have you seen that one? Take Control. I've looked at all of them and I can't find any that I would say that's really a good spread to use. Other than peanut butter, almond butter, cashew butter. Take an avocado and mash it up, put it on. Those I could all recommend. The others are, which one is not the worst? And then if you're from the Greek islands, what do they use? Olive oil, and that would be healthier too. But so anytime it's a solid, it's difficult. Take Control, I like because it's trans fat free, for one thing. And they also have added stanols and sterols. And those will trap cholesterol in your gut, and they pass right on through and keeps them from being absorbed. And by itself, it'll lower your cholesterol by 5 to 12% when they do clinical trials on it. You have to look for it. It's in some grocery stores, but not all of them. And another name that, see, another company bought them out, so it says Take Control and also says something else. Benecol would be another one of those. Mm-hmm. They are. And I used to tell people that's an advantage. You just won't use too much. But if you were going to use a spread on your bread, that one has been shown to significantly reduce your risk of heart disease. That would be one that I could recommend.
Don, since we're talking about fats, Neil Barnard, in his books, for reversing diabetes, is showing how the intermyocellular lipids can interfere with the cause insulin resistance. So his, I mean, he doesn't recommend any oils at all. Would you see that as a reversal process, but maybe not as a...
I've read his material, and I think he's getting that from a long time ago. And if you read the current data in research, that does not show that data. And all the new research shows is that polyunsaturated fats lower your insulin resistance, lower your resistance, your likelihood of getting diabetes. And instead of lowering your total fat, you need to be using more polyunsaturated fats. But I'm aware that there are people that teach that. But we wouldn't, when I say we, those nutritionists who... like the School of Health and the nutrition department, and those people wouldn't recognize that as the best approach. All right. Where are we now? I want to jump ship here a little bit, and we'll go on to the next one. So find the one on exercise, and we're going to try to cover as many of these as we can. When you begin looking at the benefits of exercise, you'll find that it's got a lot of things that it can do for positive benefit to our health. And here you just see a quick list, don't you? Look at those lists: high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, some of the cancers, osteoporosis, depression. There's a whole host of things that exercise can help. And we will look at some of these quickly in some of the original research so you can see some of the data. I'm of the impression, being that most Adventists don't smoke and don't drink a lot, that if we got exercise on a regular basis, it would help improve the health of our church members more than any other one single thing we can do. And as you go through here, you'll see why I talk about that. First thing is exercise is very healthy for the heart, isn't it? And is very good for keeping the heart healthy and the coronary arteries open. And some of the ways that they improve is they, of course, improve the circulation. They decrease inflammation. And if you read about the cause of heart disease, inflammation is kind of the underlying cause. It's what irritates the arteries, and that's where the cholesterol goes in, where that inflammation is. Later on, when the coronary arteries are built up with a lot of cholesterol and plaques, it's the inflammation in those plaques that cause the plaques to rupture. When they rupture, that's when the red blood cells cause a clot there, and almost all heart attacks are caused by that disease process. The inflammation, the rupturing of the plaque, the red blood cells collecting there and plugging that artery, and whether it goes to the brain, it's a stroke, goes to the heart, it's a heart attack, if it goes to the kidney, may cause kidney failure. But the underlying process is inflammation, and one thing that exercise does is to reduce inflammation in the body. Also, losing weight does that. It improves the blood fat. Your triglyceride levels go down, and that's helpful, and your HDL levels go up, and that's helpful. HDL, remember, is to clean out those vessels. And of course, exercise helps prevent obesity, helps to lower the blood pressure, helps to lower blood sugar. All of those have a direct effect on the health of the heart and the circulation. So over here on the right, you see a coronary artery. And see if I can get my little pointer up here. The left-hand side here, that's about what a healthy artery should like. Should be about 1/4 the distance of the lumen or the opening of that artery. But notice on this side, that's pretty thick, isn't it? And what does all this yellow stuff look like?
Fat.
Looks like fat, doesn't it? That's what it is. Triglyceride, cholesterol, fatty material. And what happens is it builds up in that artery wall. And as that artery wall gets thicker and thicker, what happens to the opening? Well, it impedes the circulation, doesn't it? And that's what we're trying to prevent. So keeping that artery open is what's critical for both heart health and for preventing strokes, and that's where exercise helps. Now, here's one of the earlier studies done. This is a Harvard study on the nurses study. They had 72,000 women. After about 10 years, they looked to see who had a heart attack, shown here on the left-hand side. And they simply looked at walking. And here are those that didn't get any exercise. And then we go over here to those who got 1 hour per week. Did it make a difference? It dropped the risk by a third, or almost, didn't it? Almost 30%. So even 1 hour of exercise helps. And that's the new thing about fitness. They say any exercise you do is helpful. Okay? But if you get more, what happens? What if you're getting 3 hours per week? Then what's your risk? Well, it's cut in half, isn't it? You see that? So isn't that amazing? Just 3 hours of walking a week, you can cut your risk of a heart attack in half. What else could you do that would be that easy and have such a profound effect? So anyway, walking is a good exercise. Now, if you did more, you see more benefit, but not the big change. Where's the big change? Biggest one is from doing nothing to doing something, isn't it? And that's kind of the good news about exercise. We see that in several areas. Now, here's the corollary of that, or the opposite of that. Sitting too much is not good for your health either, is it? Maybe we all ought to jump up here and do some exercise. Here's a study, 17,000 men and women for 12 years, and they simply asked them how much they sat. And what do you see? As the percentage of time goes up, particularly after you get around 50% of your time sitting, and then up to 75%, and people sit most of the time, their risk of a heart attack is almost doubled. Isn't that fascinating? Now, this trend is the same even if you have an exercise program. And I don't have that slide with this set of slides, but I've got it, and we showed it to our Fitness for Life class we just finished. But even if you take people who exercise regularly and then look at their sitting time, when you get down to these last two categories, they're not quite as high, but they're up to about 50% increased risk of dying. So when we're talking about exercise, there's two things we need to do. One is to exercise. Number two, don't sit so much. But think about it. A typical person would get up in the morning, and they come down, and they sit, and they eat breakfast, and they go out and get in their car, and they sit as they commute to work. And if it's a long way, it might take a half an hour or an hour. And then they get to work, and what do? We don't really work anymore, do we? We just sit. Work on the computer. We talk on the phone. Whatever it is, a lot of people, that most of the day they sit at work, and then it's time to go home, and we go out and we sit in the car, and we drive home, we eat dinner, and we sit, and then what do they do after dinner? We go in and sit in front of the TV, exercise their thumb on the little controller, and it's nighttime and we go to bed. You know, that's kind of typical of our society, isn't it? And so we sit so much, and that's hard on the body. And so another guideline is never sit more than about 30 to 60 minutes without getting up and walking around. So I do that at work now. I have a desk that I sit at. Right next to it, I have a desk that I can stand up at. Anytime the phone rings, I jump up and I go over to the stand-up desk. And I can take notes and write things and do whatever. And if I'm working on my laptop computer, I can work at the stand-up desk. And if we're going to have a committee meeting, sometimes I'll say, well, could we do this meeting while we're walking? And we can go outside and we walk for 15 or 20 minutes, we take care of our business, we come back to work. Why can't we be more active, you see, in our regular routine? So I'm thinking of doing some of these things to try to break up my city. It's an independent from our exercise. Exercise helps a little bit, but doesn't take away all the risk. So a lot of things that exercise does, and I'm going to go through this kind of quickly here. It's certainly very helpful for blood pressure. And here's a study that shows that. And this is a group of 2,500 people followed for 15 years. They all had healthy blood pressures when they started. And then notice over these 15 years, this is broken down instead of quintiles, this time it's quartiles or fourths. So here's the fourth of the people who were least active in their rate of developing high blood pressure. And notice that every level of increase in daily activity, the number of people who got high blood pressure went down. So again, in those who are most active, cut the risk at least in half for high blood pressure. How about diabetes? Interested in preventing diabetes? Same thing. Here's a large study, 8,000 people. They studied for 6 years. They all had normal blood sugar levels at the beginning. And here are the people who are the high fitness people. Here are the people who don't get any exercise. Look at that huge difference over that 6 years and who developed diabetes. The lower fit people, 3.7 times more likely to get diabetes. If they were moderately fit, what had happened? Well, it's kind of halfway in between, isn't it? And that was protective too. But the people who got the most exercise had the most benefit. What if you already have diabetes? Is exercise helpful? And that's what this slide shows. 2,800 and some people, 8-year study, and they, some of the people who had diabetes exercised and some didn't. And this is the risk of dying from any cause, over here on the left, no exercise. If they got 2 hours per week, what did it do? Dropped the risk nearly 40%. That's pretty good, isn't it? By the time they got 3 to 4 hours per week, it dropped it by more than half, 54%. So if you have diabetes, is it important to exercise? If you know a diabetic friend, you can say, I can tell you how you can cut your risk of dying in half in the next 10 years. And they say, well, what is that? And what's your answer?
3 to 4 hours.
Walk 3 to 4 hours per week. Easy prescription, isn't it? Okay, so even if you have a health problem, diabetes, it can be very helpful. How about your bones? Interested in keeping your bones healthy? We find that exercise is good for that, not only the walking and things or jogging, but the weight-bearing or strengthening exercises. Puts a strain on that bone. And here's what we see here. Hours walked per week. This is a study of about, I think it's close to 60,000 people, I think. I don't see it listed here. Anyway, as exercise, hours walked per week go up, the risk of a hip fracture goes down, doesn't it? How about exercise and weight control? A lot of good data on that, isn't there? And here's a real interesting study that's really quite surprising, was when I first saw it. A very careful study, about 25,000 people for 10 years of follow-up, and they put people on the treadmill and tested them so they knew who was getting exercise and who weren't. The yellow is the fit group and the blue is the unfit. So let's look in the unfit group first. Here's the unfit people who have normal weight, and on this side we have relative risk of death from any cause. Okay, so here's the people who are normal weight and sedentary, overweight and sedentary, and obese and sedentary. And what is that trend? As their weight goes up, more likely to die from any cause, aren't they? Now, here's the people who are getting regular exercise and are fit. Here's the normal weight, overweight, and obese. What trend do you have there? Practically no difference. Is that surprising? It is, isn't it? And what we find out is that everything that weight does bad for us, exercise seems to be almost like an antidote for it. So when we're overweight, the blood pressure goes up. When we exercise, blood pressure goes down. When you're overweight, triglycerides go up and HDLs go down. When you exercise, it reverses just both of those problems. And as you go through and look at everything that weight does that's bad for us, exercise almost always does just the opposite. So we found that working at corporations, if we can't get everybody skinny, what we try to do then is get everybody moving. If you can't be skinny, at least exercise and be fit. Does that make good sense? And it's kind of encouraging, isn't it? Because anytime you work with a large group of people, you're probably not going to get the majority of them skinny if they're overweight. Will you? The research is pretty dubious that you're going to get a lot of people to lose a lot of weight and keep it off. But what you can do is get everybody walking, everybody exercising, even if they're somewhat overweight, and it can take a lot of that risk away. Okay, here's one, exercise and smoking. And we'll just look at this slide here to start with. Here's a group of 25,000 people, 19 years of follow-up, very careful study. Here are the smokers who are sedentary. Here's the smokers who exercise. Does it make a difference in risk of death from any cause? It cuts it about in half, doesn't it? Isn't that exciting? So if you have smokers that have a hard time quitting, and is that kind of the rule? Most smokers would quit if they could easily. but they have a hard time. So if they can't quit, what can they do?
Exercise.
They can start exercising. Now, I did this at a corporation right close to where my office is. It was Safeway Bakery. They make all the bread for the Safeway stores up and down the West Coast, clear to Alaska. And they wanted to start an exercise program. When I went over there, about 30% of their people were smokers. We started a real good exercise program, and you know, after about 5 years, what happened? Smoking just took care of itself. Smoking got in the way of their exercise, and over 5 years, almost all those people stopped. And at the end of 5 years, we had maybe four or five people that were still smoking. So we had some special classes and helped those people, and over 6 or 7 years, we completely eliminated. There was not one smoking employee at that plant. But we started with fitness. And sometimes that's a good place to start. Now, let's compare here. Here's the person who's a smoker and exercises. Over here, we have what? A non-smoker who doesn't exercise. Who's more likely to die? Is that a little bit shocking? Okay, here's the death rate from any cause. Over here is a non-smoker who's sedentary. Over here we have the smoker, but who exercises, who's at higher risk? This guy over here, isn't he? So sometimes I play a little bit with churches when I'm doing this. I said, I've heard a rumor that in the Adventist church, if you smoke, you can't be a member. But if you're overweight and sedentary, you can be the head elder. If you're overweight and sedentary, you can be the head elder. Is that rumor right? Don't we do funny things? You know, we always like to look at the other fellow. We don't like to look at ourselves, do we? Now, I'm not criticizing any groups or promoting smoking, but sometimes we get real hard on some sins, but the other sins are okay. We just need to think of them as we all have areas of needing to improve, don't we? And I guess what I'm promoting is tolerance. Let's love everyone, right? And encourage everyone. And maybe the smoker who's exercising is actually even doing better than some of us in the church who are non-smokers but not exercising. All right, here's one: exercise and cancer. You know anybody in your family or friends who died of cancer? Let's look at some of the risk data on here. Here's one for exercise and breast cancer risk. This is from the Women's Health Initiative study. And 74,000 women for nearly 5 years. Here's those who are inactive and their risk of developing breast cancer during those 5 years. Here's those who exercise 30 to 60 minutes. Does it make a difference? Well, it's not a huge difference, but it's down about 20%, isn't it? And if you've looked at the data from the number of lives you can save from doing mammography, you'll find that that's very much in line. The best study that's been done was over in Sweden. Very large study, and they estimated that you could reduce the risk of dying from breast cancer by about 19% if you get your mammogram regularly. However, how do they save your life? Through surgery or chemotherapy. In this case, you don't have to get the cancer. So it's not a bad way to reduce the risk, is it? About 20%, about one out of every breast cancers they figure could be prevented if people exercised regularly. Here's the one on physical activity and colon cancer. I don't have anything against getting mammograms. That's important. But what I'm getting at is doctors should be telling their patients to exercise too. That would have even a better result. So here's colon cancer. Nearly 30,000 men, 12 years of study. And notice here, here's the one that gets the least amount of exercise. Here's the one who gets the most. What is that? That's a two-thirds decrease, isn't it? Isn't that something? If people all exercised, you could decrease the risk of colon cancer by two-thirds. And colon cancer is the second leading cause of death from cancer in the United States.
I think that's partly because of the increased mortality.
There's a lot of reasons. As you exercise, your body weight comes down. That is helpful. You have a faster transit time of the material in your colon, and that seems to give less exposure and reduces the risk. There may be some immune factors that may be a factor. We do know that there's a hormone changes. As you exercise, your blood sugar levels come down. People who have high blood sugar have more cancer. If you have high insulin levels related to that, that increases your risk for cancer. As you bring the weight down, there's other hormonal changes that can take place. So there's a variety of things. But anyway, it's very protective. And as far as we know, it's one of the most protective things you can do in preventing colon cancer. Here's one on pancreatic cancer. Isn't that interesting? Have you had any friends or family that died of pancreas cancer? When they get it, how long do they have? Not long, do they? And so if you want to be effective, there's really not much you can do in treating it. But as you can see here, there's quite a bit you can do in reducing the risk, isn't there? Preventing it. So here they found that people who walk 4 hours or more per week cut the risk by 54%. Even if you got 1.5 to 3 hours, it cut it by a third, didn't it? So is that encouraging? It is, isn't it? We can do something even to prevent cancer. Now here's one on exercise and mental health. And particularly talking about, it says physical activity protects against depression, cognitive decline with age, anxiety, feelings of distress, and fatigue. So a lot of things that can affect our mental health and our well-being, isn't it? And here's one interesting study done by Duke University. A psychiatrist had people who came to him for clinical depression, 156 people. And he says, we're going to do an experiment. We're going to put half of them on medication, as we normally do. But the other half, we're going to put on an exercise program. So they took them down to the track. They walked briskly for a half an hour, talked about their exercise and so on, didn't talk about their problems. He did this for 16 weeks and then evaluated the two groups, and here's what he found. Exercisers improved as much as those on medication. Isn't that interesting? I thought that was pretty good of the psychiatrist, who says if you just get out and exercise, you'll get just as much benefit as visiting your psychiatrist and taking all these medications. And anytime we take a medication, what are we doing? We may have some side effects. They're not always without side effects. And so anyway, exercise was very careful. Now they've tested that again, and at the same university, and they come out with follow-up reports. And here's what they found. As a year or 2 years later, they found that exercise was much more effective than even the medication for people who got over their depression, but then maybe who went back and got it again. In other words, exercise helped them from going back and getting depression again. So that's positive, isn't it? Very good. That kind of a lifestyle change can make a big difference. But notice down here, only the exercisers, not those taking the medication, found improvement in what? Mental abilities, such as concentration, planning, and organization. Isn't that interesting? So the people taking the medicine didn't get this, but those who exercise, not only did their depression goes down, their brain worked better. They could think better. Now here again, another study. This is about 5,000 men and 1,000 women. And they took an inventory called the well-being score. By the way, if you get our little stress profile back there, the little package we have, it has this well-being inventory in it. It's a self-scoring. And it's kind of fun to see how you're coping with stress in your life. And here's what they found. They correlated their scores, and the higher the scores, the better their mental health, okay? And then they correlated that with how many miles per week they were getting in their walking or jogging programs. And you notice, here's people who don't get any regular exercise. Those who got 1 to 9 miles, 10 miles, or 20 more miles per week. And what do you see? Every time there was an increase in activity level, their mental, emotional scores improved. There's a close correlation between physical exercise and fitness and how the brain works. Now let's look at it on the women's side. Women, here are those that didn't get much exercise as it went up. Notice what happened to those scores. Even more dramatic than for men, isn't it? So exercise is one of the positive things we can do for improving mental health. So that as you look through this evidence, we've been looking at some pretty serious common problems, haven't we? And in every case, fitness is a tremendous help. Now, how about in living longer? The first study was the Alameda County study, about 6,000 people. And they found that exercise, of all the things they asked, was the best predictor of a long, healthy life in that group of people. Here's another study, 102,000 men and women. And during that, over the time of 26 years of follow-up, that's a long time, isn't it? They found 6,910 cases of death from any cause. And then they looked through and looked at their different risk factors, and they found that physical activity was the best predictor of survival, more important than any of these risk factors down here, even after they held constant for that. And here we see the results. Here's the mortality level for those who were highly fit, those who got moderate exercise, and those who didn't get any regular exercise. That's where the big drop is again, isn't it? Even moderate exercise has significant savings or benefits, high fitness even more. But notice those people who were sedentary, 70% more likely to die during those, what was it, 29 years. That's a big difference, isn't it? Now, which of those categories do you want to be in? This one or that one? Do we have a choice? We do, don't we? Every morning when we get up and we decide, am I going to put on my tennies or Nikes or whatever you got and go out and hit the road today, or am I going to lay in bed and enjoy another half hour of sleep? Okay. Or jump on your bicycle and ride to work or whatever it is you enjoy doing. And now here's another one, a little smaller numbers, but 12 years. People who are 60 and above. Do people who are 60 and above, do they need to exercise? As we get older, we may even need it more, right? And so here's what they found. Here's the quintiles again. Those who got the least amount of exercise and their death from any cause. And then as they went from there just to moderate exercise, look at that big jump. And again, we've seen that. A 50% reduction in risk of dying from any cause. If they got more exercise and more exercise and more exercise, the risk went down, didn't it? So by the time they're the most highly fit, their risk of dying was 73% lower than the person who got no exercise. Very powerful predictor, isn't it?
And in
this one, we don't. But by the time you're up here, that person is getting probably more, at least a half an hour to 45 minutes or maybe an hour a day. They just divide it in those quintiles so they can compare it to, as the exercise goes up, what happens to risk. Here's a quotation I like from Ellen White, written in Councils on Health, page 52. And she says, all who can possibly do so ought to walk in the open air at least twice a week. Right? Oh, three times a week. Huh? Every day. Isn't that kind of radical? Every day, she says, summer and winter, a walk even in winter would be more beneficial to the health than all the medicine the doctors may prescribe. Do you believe that? Well, we just looked at the evidence, didn't we? And so now we have, we've learned this, and because the evidence is so compelling, the American College of Sports Medicine and the American Medical Association have a joint venture now, and it's called Exercise is Medicine. Have you heard about it? And they're targeting particularly physicians in our nation to educate them and encourage them to see that if they start making regular changes in what they're telling their patients to start exercising, they're going to get tremendous results. Exercise is Medicine. It's the American Medical Association and the American College of Sports Medicine, and they've started this program to train physicians to encourage them to talk to their patients about exercise because it's the most powerful medicine that they have to their be able to give to their patients. And you can see across all these areas. Now, if you take a medication and it's effective, that's one thing, but what's it likely to have? A whole bunch of side effects. Sometimes they can be really serious, can't they? What's the side effect of exercise? Your brain might work better. We might weigh less. A lot of positive side effects, right? As well as the one they might be prescribing it for. So it's something that can be very beneficial. I think I saw a hand here, yeah.
Good question. Obviously, these studies are, is there some quantification of when they say all these people died eventually? do they quantify how much longer? In other words, if 50% live longer, is it one day longer or 6 days longer? I mean,
they're looking at the number of deaths in the 12 years or the 29 years or however long it is, right, which gives us a pretty good idea. But then how much longer do they live? That's a good question. And I, in our other class, we started that, but I don't see it here. In the Adventist health study, they lived about 3.5 years longer. A study that came out of China recently showed that people who got as little as 15 minutes of exercise daily over most of their life lived up to 3 years longer. A study out of Harvard, Dr. Paffenbarger, who worked with the Harvard alumni, 16,000 of them, and he looked at how much longer they lived, and the way he stated it was that for every hour they exercised, they lived 2 hours longer. I thought that was a good way to compare it. So some people say, I don't have time to exercise. So I say, well, make time to die sooner then. It's not a bad investment, is it? Every hour you exercise, you live 2 hours longer. And so that's a good investment, isn't it? One that I like to do. Yeah, what's the guy doing with the tie on out there in the rink? He must be an Adventist. He's a very proper gardener, isn't he? Maybe he's English. Okay, so what kind of exercises cause us to live longer? It's the aerobic exercises, aren't there? And we can see them listed here. And so just a few points about how to get started, things that's important. Here's the recommendations from the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans. These are guidelines that came out about a year ago. And recommendations for all people in America. And they say at least how many minutes? At least a half an hour a day, 4 to 5 days per week of what kind of activity? Moderate activity, which is probably best for most people when they're starting out. Or 20 minutes, 3 to 4 days per week of what kind? Vigorous activity. So if you're a jogger, you're working at an exercise intensity about twice what it is to walk. So you only have to go half as long. And if you do either one of those, you get about the same effects on your health as far as aerobic capacity is concerned. Or it says a combination of both. So what I like to do is try to have something that's done daily or nearly every day, but at least twice a week do something more vigorous. So I jump on my bike and I've got a great big hill. It takes me about 45 minutes to get to the top. If you ride a bicycle uphill, that's good exercise. That challenges me and gets the heart pumping a little more, and that gives me something a little more vigorous. The other days, I just walk up the hill and back down. It's not quite as strenuous. Or swim or some other kind of activity. So it's kind of nice to do a little of both. Just make careful not to go overboard. Now, down here, it says the minimum exercise time is how much? 10 minutes per session. So that means you could do 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at noon, and 10 minutes at night and get a similar benefit. If it's any less than that, you're not doing an exercise for long enough to get your heart rate up, sustained a little bit, stimulating the metabolism, and getting the changes to take place that gives you an improved health. See how that works? So that's the guidelines for all Americans. And they recommend starting out with moderate activities. You can see a list of them over there. And a heart rate of about 50 to 70% of maximum heart rate. You should break a little sweat when you're doing aerobic activity. And you should be breathing harder. It says you can talk, but not sing during the activity. So if you were out walking with someone, you should be able to carry on a conversation, but if you can sing, you better walk a little faster. Okay? Because you need to get the heart rate and the breathing up, and that's showing you that you're challenging the system. If you don't go fast enough, you're not going to get much improvement. Vigorous activities, they recommend about 70 to 85% of heart rate. You need to sweat heavily, you're getting more energy going, getting the body heat up more, and you're breathing harder. You cannot say more than just a few words without pausing for a breath, but you should still be able to talk to the person next to you. Okay, these are kind of signs of intensity, and you can see a list of more vigorous exercises over there. Those are okay for anyone as long as they're used to exercise, but if you're not used to it, you'd start with the moderate and work up, and then when you're ready, then you might go into something more vigorous. Or if you're older and you just want to go with moderate exercises, fine, just do them longer. You'll get the same benefit. This is just a little thing, and we'll just skip that. Progression. If you haven't been active in a while, start slowly. It may have taken a person 5 or 10 years to get out of shape. Don't try to get back into shape in 5 or 10 days, right? Because you may cause a problem. So choose activities that are appropriate for your fitness level. Build up the time you spend, and then if you want to, you can switch to more vigorous activities. A few ideas on safety, the recommendations. This is their statement by the Office of Disease Prevention and Health, our government. It says, physical activity is generally safe for who? Everyone. People who are physically fit have less chance of injury than those who are not fit. The health benefits you gain from being active are far greater than the chances of getting hurt. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Usually we're always cautioning everybody, and if you're going to exercise, make sure you don't kill yourself. Well, that's good advice. But even more important advice is if you don't exercise, you need to run down and get an exam by your doctor, because that's a very high-risk activity. See what I mean? We're putting it in perspective. Being inactive is definitely not good for your health. So if you do have a problem, of course, a health problem, diabetes or a heart problem, it's a good idea to check with your doctor. But if you start with moderate activities, most people don't need to see their doctor. And some other guidelines, a warm-up, a cool-down, using the right kind of gear, exercising in safe places and so on. And see your health care provider if you have any health problems, just to get some good advice. Now, here's some principles that help if you're starting an exercise program. People are more likely to be successful if they have a goal. And here's some different kinds of goals. If you're doing hourly, 2.5 hours per week, that's the minimum goal that's recommended for all Americans. That'd be about half an hour, 5 days a week, wouldn't it? That would be the 2.5 hours. Another way to look at it is mile goals, if you like to do miles. And at our company, we have these three goals, and we have incentives on each of those goals when employees meet that on a regular basis. And those who get the most discount on their health insurance at our company, they put in 15 to 20 miles per week. Other people might like to do steps. Have you used the little pedometer? Clip it on your belt, and as you walk, it counts your steps. Some of you have them on here. Good. All the research shows if you take two groups of people, you give them the same pep talk on exercise and fitness, one group gets a pedometer and the other one doesn't, guess who exercises the most? Pedometer group do. It's fun to look at. And you say, well, look at here, I've got 3,000 steps. I wonder if I could, what I have to do to get 5,000. Pretty soon they're doing 5,000. They say, well, I wonder what I have to do to get 6,000. And what we do at our work, we've given to all of our employees. And so we meet one another on the walk at work, and I pull out my pedometer and I say, I've got 5,000 steps today so far. How much do you have? And they say, well, we've got 6,000. I say, great, keep it up. So we kind of compare, and everybody's working at it. And we tell people, if you want to be really fit, how many steps do you need? 10,000 steps in a day. Maybe you've seen the little t-shirt out there and the In Step for Life program and so on. 10,000 steps a day if you want to be really fit. So it's worked, it's kind of a feedback mechanism, and you can look at it all day long. And when I'm wearing mine and I get home at night and it says I only have 9,500 steps and it's almost time to go to bed, what am I going to do? Well, in Portland this time of year, it's raining or it's snowy or messy outside and it's dark. So I have a route in my house, and I've got upstairs, and I go up the stairs in one side, cross the top of the house, come down the stairs on the back side. My wife thinks I'm crazy. What in the world are you doing? And I do that about 4 or 5 times, and I've got my 1,000 steps in. Well, what does it do? Well, you see, it's just programming your brain, isn't it? I've got a goal. I want to work towards it. I'm almost there. What am I going to do the rest of this day, you see, to get those extra few steps in? It just helps us to be faithful and regular and get our steps in. It's kind of a psychological thing, but it works.
10,000 is about a mile, right?
Oh, my, no. It's more like 5 miles. By the time you walk 10,000 steps, you know you've exercised that day. When you first start out, it may be too much. That's why we've got 8,000. Or you might even start out with 5 or 6,000. And then slowly gradually work up over the time of weeks. The 14,000 steps per day research has shown that people who have weight to lose and they really are serious about it, they're most likely to get their weight down if they do that. The second thing that makes them most likely to be successful is they have a goal and then they log their steps or their time or whatever it is that you're keeping track of, miles. And people who write it down in their little planner, or now we have an online little application for your iPhone. Have you used those yet? And if you haven't, it's free and you can go on there and download it. And I got to look for mine on here. There it is, In Step for Life, Adventist In Step for Life. You can download it right on your phone and you click it and there's today's, and you, when you're ready to log, you hit the logging calendar. You put in your, you can either put in steps or miles or minutes. And if you put in steps or minutes, it converts it to miles on a little formula, and you can keep track for the whole year. So, and on their website, on North American Division website, on In Step for Life, you'll find a lot of other information and things. There's a coordinator's guide if you want to start a program at your church, and how to have a nice little exercise program, and how to coordinate it, and so on. And they have awards. When they get to the 100-mile award or the 500-mile award, you can call the people up front and recognize them and pass them a nice certificate, and it's fun. I've done this, we did this with Nike Corporation. I tested all their employees for years at their, they have their world headquarters right there in Portland. And we would have our award ceremony. We'd have 500 or 600 people there getting their awards.
In Step for Life was the name of the app?
Yes. Uh-huh. You might put Adventist In Step. Uh-huh. The first year or two I ran it, we just called it In Step for Life, and then they wanted to upgrade the program, and so we did, and we put the name Adventist in front of it, and it's now on the Adventist NAD website. Okay, so logging, keeping track, having goals. Same way like on a daily goal as I have a weekly goal. Right now my goal is to have do 20 aerobic miles per week. And so if I get towards the end of the week and I'm not there, what do I do? Well, I begin to think, what am I going to do now? Well, I could ride my bike to work tomorrow. I could do this. I could do that. And we begin to plan so that we reach our goal. So it keeps it in our mind. We're more likely to be successful.
I just wanted to give a personal testimony.
Good. Most of us are that way.
My husband and I, several years ago,
you had a goal, and you worked towards it, and you wrote it down. And this is what we recommend you do in your churches. If you have a club or something there, take a map and put it up there. We did this in our church, and I just put a map up, and we were in Portland, Oregon, and it was right then that they had the big hurricane and things down in the south. So we decided to walk down to the south to help them. And so the people would turn in their results, and every week we could track our progress. Didn't take us very long till we got down there. Then we got down there, we took up a big collection and set money down to help the hurricane people that may needed help. So anyway, you can do fun things like that. You can walk across the United States. You can walk across your own state, put people together in groups, and you can walk a little faster. It's just kind of fun to do that, isn't it? So having goals, keeping records can make it fun, and then usually have some kind of a little special treat when you reach it. So how do we stay motivated? Well, one of the things is choosing activities you enjoy. I like to think of exercise as play, not as work. And try a variety of exercises. Why not invite someone to exercise with you? That's more fun, isn't it? And so I like to invite my wife every morning, and she can come most mornings. Some mornings she can't. And we exercise together, and we have a social time together, and it makes it more fun. And then some mornings, maybe when I'm not ready to exercise, she'll say, "No, come on, time to go." And she can encourage me, you see, so we can encourage one another. So having an exercise buddy, spouse, a child, a friend, a neighbor, it can make it more fun and it can help us to be successful and not give up. And then if you have a little reward, and you might have a little mini vacation or some new fitness gear when you reach a certain level. Now here's a couple of people that are kind of interesting. I thought you might like to see them. This is the world's oldest woman marathon finisher. She's a Seventh-day Adventist, lives just south of me a little ways. And I ran the This is the Honolulu Marathon. I ran that with her in 2010, so when I first met her. She looks pretty good there for 92, doesn't she? And where most of her friends are either in the nursing home or dead, she's out having life, enjoying life. She chose life. It took her quite a while, but she finished. And she didn't run her first marathon until when? The age of 86. That's pretty late to be starting. So some people say, I'm too old to exercise. Well, she started at 86 and ran her first marathon. And you don't have to run marathons, by the way. It is kind of fun to do a few. I've run about 19 so far. But I've retired from that now. But we do need some exercise every day. And the point is she exercises, takes good care of her health, and she trains now. Notice there at the bottom, how much? Wow, 30 to 50 miles each week. And another place she was talking about it, she says, I don't have any pains, I feel good. And she's healthy, she's vital. And if you want to reach that 100-year mark, she's well on her way, isn't she? Okay, we'll just stop there. Any questions on exercise? Comments? Yes. Gingerly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. If they weigh that much, you want to be careful that they don't walk so much they cause a problem, knee problems or hip problems or some other problems. And you might want to find exercises that are less stressful on the joints and things, maybe water aerobics and so forth. At Nike Corporation, we had a lady that was very heavy like that. She needed to lose a lot, and she was younger. She could do it, and she walked, but she walked briskly. And she decided to take her noon hour every day at work. So at eating lunch, she would walk for an hour. She got back, I think she had a little yogurt and something, but that was all. And so she'd go out, and she'd walk briskly for an hour. She'd cover 4 miles. She did that over a period of a year, and with some other things too. She lost over 100 pounds. But you usually take some serious commitment. And usually that person needs to exercise closer to an hour a day if you're really going to make changes. But be careful of going too intense, especially at the beginning.
Remember the old adage, you only need to exercise on the days that you eat.
There you go. I like that one. Only need to exercise on the days you eat. Okay, very good. Let's go down to the next one here. I think I'll let you read the one on healthy weight on your own. There's some good slides in there. Is that a problem in our churches?
No.
We're not any skinnier than the general population, are we? And so taking some time to help on that, and you may want to run a weight management program. We have one back here we call Weight Management for Lifelong Health, and there's others, I'm sure, too. There's the Full Plate Diet and others. Or you may want to just encourage your people to join what's available in the community, like Weight Watchers and other good programs. But anyway, dealing with weight, and I think developing just good eating habits and exercise patterns can help our whole congregation prevent weight gain. Is sleep important for our health? We're recognizing that it is. And I'm going to bring that one up, I think, and just look. It's a short one. We will shortly. And if you'd like to get a copy of these, if you will put your name on a list at the WellSource table, we'll let you know when they're ready. And the slides are ready, but I haven't put all the speaker notes in that might be helpful.
Are they all going to be one program?
No, they'll be separate, just like they are here. They'll all be on one disc. Sleep and your health. Now, you'll notice when you look at yours, the type is very small. What we're trying to do is test your vision. If you can read those, you pass. If you don't, you might want to see your eye doctor. Actually, what happened there, I didn't have the ones that I'm preparing for with bigger type for up here. So I shortened those up and made bigger type so it's easy to read. But when we put it on the internet, for you to come to, it'll be like the other one that's in there. And of course, it'll be bigger, so it'll be real easy to read. It's about, I think it's 12 or 14 point type, so it's very easy to read on the screen. And we're going to have a little few more words with it, so the people, as they read it, it'll kind of do what I normally do in the talking. So there'll be more information there. So that's kind of what it'll be like when we do the on-screen one. Okay, if you get adequate sleep, you feel better. It's a vital part of health and lifestyle, and yet millions are not getting enough sleep. And some of the studies show that as much as a third or more of our nation is getting inadequate sleep. Here's what's recommended. How many hours per day? 7 to 9. Okay. And if we don't get enough sleep, what can it do? It increases the risk for obesity. Did you know that? High blood pressure, even the risk of diabetes and accidents. And it also results in low energy levels, decreased resistance to disease, poor coping ability, mood problems, impaired memory and learning ability, and people who don't get enough sleep die sooner. So it's a pretty important thing, isn't it? You see, at the daytime, when we're active, we're in a type of metabolism called catabolism. Are you familiar with that term? And catabolism is when we're using up the body's resources and reserves. So it's kind of breaking down all the things that we have. Then at night when we go to sleep, it changes into what's called anabolism. And anabolism is when we're building back all the resources and the reserves and so on. And that's when our muscles get stronger. It's at sleep at night when our memories and the things we've learned all day are fixed into our brain permanently. And a whole bunch of important things happen. And if we don't get enough sleep, then what's the result? We break the body down, but we don't build it back up. And if you do that on a chronic basis, pretty soon our health goes down and it causes serious problems. So getting adequate sleep is a real important factor for good health. Here the study shows that about a third, 35.3% of the people, are getting less than the recommended amount. Notice also 38% of people report that they unintentionally fall asleep during the day. That might be a clue. And 5% report nodding off or falling asleep while doing what? Driving. Not a good sign, isn't it? Just in the last month. So we have a lot of signs that getting inadequate sleep, a lot of our population are. And of course, that can be very dangerous, can't it? So this is the one that talks about sleep improving our memory, like we just talked about. And we'll just slip along here quickly. Drowsy driving. Have you ever done that? I won't ask you to put your hands up. Probably most of us have some time. But notice what it results in. 40,000 accidents yearly. And 1,550 people a year die from that. So sleepy driving, not a good combination, is it? What should you do when you get sleepy? Pull off and take a nap. Some people say pull off and drink some coffee. Push yourself a little further. Well, there may be emergencies when you have to do that, but I think your body is trying to tell you it's time to rest. And so if I pull off, I can sleep for just 10 or 15 minutes. I wake up, I'm real refreshed, and I've got another 2, 3, 4 hours that I can drive without being sleepy, so it works for me. But notice when you get inadequate sleep, reaction times are slower, you're less attentive and vigilant. Your brain's ability to process information is decreased. All the same things that happen when you do what? Drink alcohol. So if you're driving drowsy, it's about the same if you're driving after having several drinks, your reaction times and so on. So not a good thing. Sleep and blood pressure. Just to go through quickly here, notice that those who got 1 hour less sleep daily than average over the period of this, what was it, 5-year study, they had a 37% increased risk of developing high blood pressure. Isn't that interesting? So sleep, getting adequate sleep can help prevent high blood pressure. Another larger sleeper study found that those who were getting only 5 hours of sleep had a 60% increased risk of developing high blood pressure. So you get the sleep down even lower, even a more serious problem. And here's the one that shows sleep and body weight. And you have different times here, those getting less than 7 hours, and that was their average BMI. What is BMI? Body mass index, and it is a way of measuring your weight for your height. And the higher your BMI, the higher the risk. So a BMI of 30 and above indicates obesity, so that group is already in that category, isn't it, on the average. Those who got 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night dropped down to 29, and those who got 9 or more hours of sleep per day, even less. Isn't that interesting? I had a director of the FAA, Federal Aviation Agency, who was the person who was responsible for the nation of keeping pilots safe and healthy so that they won't have an accident and the plane crashes and people be killed. He says, we've gone a long ways now towards making the airplanes goof-proof. Very few failures in the airplane. He says, our weak link is the pilots. We're still working on those. And sometimes the pilots fall asleep. I hate to tell you this. Some of you will be going back on planes here in a little bit. And he told a few stories. I don't know if I should tell these or not. But one of them was flying from the East Coast, and they got to Seattle, and they were supposed to stop. And both pilots were sound asleep, and the plane kept on going. And they were ringing little bells in the cabin and everything else, trying to wake them up. And they finally woke up, and they were about 200 or 300 miles out over the ocean already. Finally woke up the pilots, and they woke up, turned around, came back, and landed. Not a good thing, is it? So they're interested in how to keep their pilots awake and alert. And so we were talking about this, and he said they've done studies, and they did different hours of sleep per night, and 7 hours, and 8 hours, and 9 hours, and then they would give them dexterity tests and so on, where they would have to do physical things with their hands and solve problems and see how fast they could do it. And they found that their skills and abilities improved up to 9 hours of sleep per night. Even when they got 8 hours, and they went from 8 to 9 hours, they could show improvement in their mind's ability and skills and physical skills and so on. And I thought that was a little bit of an insight, isn't it? How much sleep do we really need? And we can get by on 7. We may think we can get by on 6, but we may not be performing at our peak capacity. And especially my airplane pilot, I want him to do really well. Because I got a long ways to go tomorrow. Portland, Oregon. Okay. Sleep helps you cope better. One of the things that we don't get enough sleep, we don't do very well in coping. We get kind of grumpy and grouchy, don't we? And every little problem that comes along, it seems like it's a make a mountain into a molehill. We get all upset about it. And so improving coping ability. Here's one on sleep and longevity. Getting adequate sleep improves your chances of a longer life. And here they found that the people who got less than 7 hours had a 26% increase in mortality from any cause compared to people who got 7 to 8 hours of sleep. That's quite an increase, isn't it? And so we need to get more sleep. Here's some suggestions that might help. We're not going to take much time. You can read these. We find that people who exercise regularly sleep better. Exercise helps reduce stress, helps you relax. People who get more exercise, they fall to sleep faster. They sleep better all night long, and they sleep a little longer, just naturally. So I always tell people, if you're not sleeping well enough, you just haven't walked far enough yet that day. I remember being in graduate school, and there was lots of stress, and big exams coming up, and about ready to pull my hair out. And one night I just said, I'm going to go run until I drop, and if I die, I don't care. You know, you ever been to that place? And I took off. That was the days I was running marathons as a president of a running club at that time. And I ran and I ran and I ran, and I got in 20 miles. But I remember I came back. The sun had already set. I almost had to crawl up the steps on my hands and knees to get in the house. And I crawled into bed, and I slept like a baby. All my problems were gone. And the next day, I was ready for my exam. Well, that's a little extreme, but exercise, doesn't something say in the Bible about the sweet rest of a man who exercises or works hard? Remember that proverb? The sleep of a resting man is sweet. He's tired and he goes right to sleep. Nicotine, caffeine, or stimulants, they interfere with sleep, don't they? And here's another one, avoid heavy late meals. Now, it sounds like we're taking this out of the spirit of prophecy, but we're not. We're actually taking it from National Institutes of Health and the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute. These are the recommendations. They said, if you want to sleep well, don't eat heavy late meals. It interferes with our sleep. Establish a regular sleep schedule. Body works best if we go to bed at the same time and we wake up at the same time every day. And they recommend if you have problems, you ought to do the same over the weekend. The more regular we are, the body has a certain rhythm, doesn't it? And if we stay up an hour or two later one night, we're always going to feel more poorly the next day. Relax before bedtime. Get your exercise in sooner. And relax. There might be some nice music. Listening to some calm, soothing music. Take a warm, relaxing bath. If you've got a good wife that can give you a good shoulder rub, that's always good. Or vice versa. And relaxing, and then it's time to hit the sack and go to sleep. Need a comfortable sleeping environment. The room ought to be a little colder than during the daytime. You seem to sleep better with that. And you need quiet, and you need it dark. And a comfortable mattress, pillow, and bedding. So anyway, there are suggestions on that. It says avoid alcohol close to bedtime. A lot of people think when you drink alcohol, it makes you fall asleep, and sometimes it does. But usually that person then will wake up, and they can't go back to sleep again. And so alcohol interferes with good sleep too. How about naps? Do you like naps? Naps are good if you follow two rules. One, don't take them too close to the time you go to bed. Middle of the day is better. And secondly, don't take them too long. Usually a good power nap is about 10 or 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the most. And that's what I have found to be very helpful for me. And I'm working hard at the office, and pretty soon I find I'm getting sleepy, my brain's not working very good, and my head falls down and bounces off the keyboard on the computer. And that's a sign I need my nap. And so I've got a chair right next to my office there, and I put my feet up, and I stretch out, and I'm sound asleep, always within less than 60 seconds. And I sleep for about 10, 12 minutes. I wake up, and I'm refreshed, and all the rest of the afternoon, I'm working right up here at high productivity. So naps can be good.
Is a nap still good, even if you cannot sleep?
I think so. Just closing your eyes, putting your brain in neutral for a while, and I think it has a can be even a similar benefit. And I don't know if I don't have it here, but there are studies that show that people who take naps on a regular basis live longer than those who don't. So if my wife gives me hassle, I get out those studies and I show her. It's important for me to get my nap. Okay. And if we're troubled by problems in life, you can't sleep, what else can we do? I like to pray, or I'll turn on my little light and pull out my Bible and read. And if I'm real anxious to go to sleep, I pull out my medical journals and read them. It puts me to sleep right away. But we can take our problems to God, can't we? And we can trust Him to help us. And with God, it says all things are possible. We just need to stay connected to Him. And He can bring us rest for our soul too, can't He? So there's just a quick summary. Aim for at least 7 to 8 hours every day. And if you have problems beyond that, you might need to get help from your doctor or a mental health counselor. And God knew that we would get busy and that people needed regular periods of rest and relaxation, so what did He do? He invented Sabbath. And aren't you happy for Sabbath? Where we can lay everything aside and we just say, today is my day of rest, and we can have a good night's sleep and put the work aside and for the whole weekend. And you look at most other people and you look on Sabbath and you go look at the parking lots at the office, and what do you find? Parking lots full. And they work all weekend and they just kind of get burned out. And I think God knew that we needed that rest. So He set aside one day a week as a Sabbath or a rest day. And so in addition to getting adequate sleep, it's also good to take a rest day at least once a week. helps you to get refreshed and ready to go back and do a good job. And so spending time enjoying the beautiful world God made, enjoying your family, spending time getting to know God better, that's a great kind of rest that we need too, isn't it? For best health, enjoy a Sabbath day rest every week. Okay, and this is showing what we would normally do at the end of those challenges, or these, I should say, these educational guides, as they're on the internet, as we have them on there, and you go refer to them and so on. And at the end, it'll say you can take the sleep challenge. Or if we're talking about eating more fiber, it'll take the fiber challenge. And they can download a little guide there and work on it for a week. And there's a place they can log it into their calendar, seeing how they're doing. And then we'll also have, for more information, and there'll be two or three other resources on the internet they can go and look at, and usually a handout where they can print it out, something they can post up or refer to. And so we're going to try to have on every one of these topics some nice resources where they can go for further study. All right, any questions on sleep? And then we'll take a break.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or, if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.